Manya was very, very grateful to the friend that restored that for her. She had felt when she first heard it that she was pleased that it existed, but she didn't feel it was something that she would ever want anyone else to listen to because of the quality of the tape. And she was so thrilled that it now exists in a form that other people can have and enjoy. Manya was diagnosed with her cancer just under 5 years ago, and her life from that point on was very challenging. And it was especially tragic, I think, to us in her family to see that it happened at a point when everything was just coming together for her. All of the many talents that she had developed from her teens, particularly on, just an amazing profusion of skills that she had taught herself, and that she'd funneled eventually into the study of medieval history at university. Again, I have a few words, if I can find them here, from her aunt, who talks about how her scattergun approach to life. I don't think I can find the actual quotation. I can't, but that how her scattergun approach to life and all of these many seemingly unrelated things suddenly funneled together into SCA and then medieval history. And she did a master's degree in medieval studies and proceeded off to England, where she did work in archaeology and in the restoration of artifacts. And some of you will know her from that point in her life. And when you look now at her CV, she only actually ended up working in that field for a little over a year. That was it. And at that point, she was stricken with this illness. And when she was first diagnosed, it came absolutely out of nowhere. She was diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer, which is the rarest and most virulent kind. And the original news that the family got was that there was a 2-year survival rate of 5% from the form of the illness that she had. And that turned out to be slightly old information and a little bit pessimistic, but still the prospects were not good. She entered into a long battle and a long ordeal that, again, many of you in the room have been part of. She drew an amazing community of people together around her. And I'm now going to call on Robin Goodfellow, a good friend who knew her very well, particularly through that period, and played a huge role in her care over the last few years.
As an instance or an example of Menya's will, determination, and sheer, unabashed, bloody-mindedness, I should point out that recording that you just heard was made when she had a broken wrist. She sang. Any hiccups that you note in her voice, she's in a lot of pain. She filled up a 90-minute tape for this woman because she knew she didn't have time to wait until her wrist healed. She was on the clock, so she went ahead and she did it, which I think is an immense thing to do. It just amazes me. As an example of her mystique, I've heard people argue over the origins of that song. I've heard it being used at weddings, and oh, it was a traditional song, and oh, it was carved on a stone that was found in Iceland or something like that. It was like the weirdest damn stories about where this thing came from, and I just sit there and smile, and occasionally I try to correct people, and they go, no, that's not it. All right, whatever. But you all know now. I feel like I should start off talking about how I met Menya with the words "once upon a time." Once upon a time, I didn't meet Menya. 1992, I didn't meet her. I saw her at a party. She was sitting by the fire. She was playing the smallest harp I'd ever seen. She was the second person I'd ever seen play a harp, and the first to play one that was that. I didn't know they existed that small. I was fascinated. It was like seeing a miniature cow. It was very strange. It was just, what is that? And she's cradling it, and she's playing it, and she's had like this exaggerated features and this longer than possible hair, and she's singing by the fire, and I got a sudden attack of shy, and I couldn't introduce myself to her. Yeah, I'm really shy. I have an immense natural shyness and humility. But I couldn't introduce myself to her, so I asked somebody, I said, who is that? She's really cool. She's like, yeah, she is really cool. Her name's Rhiannon. So I filed that away. Okay, name's Rhiannon. Spent the next 2 years correcting people who knew her better about what her name was. Because Menya's real pretty. That's a nice name and everything. But if her name's Rhiannon, that's what people should call her. And I got really obnoxious about it. And it's not like me at all. But and occasionally she was in the room when I was correcting people. And she just sit there and smile. And later on, once somebody finally managed to put me in the picture about what her name was, I realized that she'd been smiling because she was kind of taking... She was an imp, and she was enjoying my eventual, discomfort over it. I followed her exploits at a distance. I knew when she went to England. I knew she was starting a museum study just from, picking up on conversation. I knew she met this really cool guy. And then I found out that she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer. I heard about when she returned from England, and I heard about the diagnosis with a brain tumor following her wedding. I heard about that. And a mutual friend gave her my phone number and said, look, some reflexology might be really comforting. Why don't you call her up? And then called me up and said, you might have a new client. And so I'm like, hey, cool. I get to meet this woman again. And so I went, and during our first session, I noticed on the bottom of her right foot, she had this really big birthmark. It looked like she stepped on a chocolate and it stuck there. It was huge. And I commented on it, and she told me that when she was in university and at SCA events, she would tell, eager young men that she had a birthmark, that if she was standing on a beach wearing a string bikini, they wouldn't be able to see. But for $5, she'd show it to them. And after I picked myself up off the floor, I asked her, did you give the money back? And she didn't answer me. She just kind of, that raised eyebrow and half grin thing that she did. That was one of those. And you paid your tuition this way, didn't you? Crap. And from then on, I felt much more at ease with her. And in fact, I started visiting a little bit more regularly. Once a month, once every 2 months, go over, poke her in the feet. Sometimes Pete would cook us dinner and we'd sit around and chat and watch stupid movies or whatever. In the fall of last year, when she made an act of will, determination, sheer bloody-mindedness, after going through innumerable surgeries, which she told me about, and baffling drug regimes and doing everything within her power to fight this thing, she made the decision to, in her words, die with hair. And she asked if I would, be around. She knew that I'd been involved in palliative care before, and so she felt that even though, the minimal involvement in palliative care years ago, she felt that somehow would be more comforting to have me around. So I said, sure, I'll drop by when I can. And basically from September on, lived mostly over at Pete and Menya's house on Empire. I had no idea when I agreed to take an active role in her journey, what it would involve, or what lessons we'd both learn together. One of the first things I learned was never to underestimate the incredible, beautiful, healing power of situational Tourette's, because sometimes just screaming an obscenity is a really good feeling. It's a really good release. One of the other things I learned was that when all else fails, when drugs have been tried, and repositioning, and physical comfort, and words have been tried, and comfort just isn't coming, ice cream is the right answer. It's totally the right answer. Ben and Jerry's, preferably, in those convenient single-serving sizes that she introduced me to. Later on, as her illness progressed, I spent some time actually spending the night there, giving Pete a break and just staying overnight with her. And during these times, it was like a weekly slumber party that happened, and she rarely actually slept. we just stayed up gabbing all night. And during this time, I learned where all her sort of metaphorical funny bones were that, you know, could be tweaked whenever needed. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And the cycle of her laments, which came at about 2 o'clock in the morning, which helped later on when she developed aphasia and lost the ability to communicate clearly, which in someone as articulate and talkative as she was, the talkative part, I really understand that, personally, was very difficult for her. But I was able to, along with other people who were closely involved at the time, to sort of pick out her meaning and her intent from her tone later on. And the communication level sort of shifted a little bit. One of the other lessons that we learned together was that everything tastes better when you make dinosaur noises while eating it. And when she lost the ability to see, we learned together that everything's more impressive when you make ninja noises while doing it, because that way she could always tell where I was in the room, and it was just good. It was very entertaining for her. Just to try to keep the communication that we had between us mutually relevant through all of the changes that her body took her through. She shared with me at night sometimes her thoughts on death, which was a big, hairy, scary subject that she was looking right into the face of, and she wasn't really sure what was going to be happening. She had some ideas, though, and they were very definite ideas. They were very strong beliefs that didn't seem to fit into any sort of massively, you know, it couldn't be pigeonholed into a theology, which really impressed me, because I'm really a strong proponent of the Church of the Self myself. But she believed that when you die, you experience a moment of clarity where everything makes sense. You get the answers to all of the questions you've been seeking, and you basically rejoin like a drop of water rejoining the ocean. And the metaphor, the image of the ocean was very strong in her beliefs about death. Morris asked me, when Trinity Home Hospice stepped in, I think that was October, I don't know, it's all a blur. no, thanks. We started to write down and record what was going on, and I went out and bought paper because I took up a lot of room. And Morris asked me if I would share with you some of the things that were written down there. This happened one night where she had already developed the aphasia, so communication was a little bit more difficult. She then began to ask for something that I couldn't quite guess at. She began reaching for things, and after ascertaining that it wasn't the bear, my hand, her water, I began to hand her random objects around the room, Kleenex boxes, empty chocolate containers, books, CDs. We had a pretty good laugh, but it wasn't any of that. Finally, I asked her if she was going to tell me where the gold was buried. And she said, yes, and then made a huge production of dying, which included flailing of limbs and rolling of eyes and some deeply unconvincing gagging noises. Right on through it, she kept her marvelous sense of humor about her. Months later in the hospital, I remembered something that we talked about in September. As well as her beliefs on death, she would share with me sometime her amazement at the outpouring of love that was coming at her, like a tidal wave or an avalanche. All of the emails, hundreds, big, huge, thick books of emails from friends, total strangers, who were reporting that their lives had been improved or sometimes even saved by the work that she'd done, by publishing the information on her website. It was overwhelming to her. Months ago, Menya said that one good thing had come of all of this was that the notion that she was loved deeply and important to the people around her had finally gotten through her thick head. One of us saying so, it didn't matter enough, and two of us might have been just saying so, but all of us saying what was in the pit of our hearts for her, what love we had, what a difference she'd made, all of that stuff that we never get around to saying until we know we're on a clock, come out, and tore through her insecurities about herself, and she came to know how beloved and special she was seen to be. She said to me, maybe that's worth 30 or 40 years. Maybe. But I think we were just emotional enough. Days later in the hospital, I had a little epiphany while sitting out in the little common room that was there. Thinking about how much she'd meant to me and how very much I was going to miss her. Even in the state where she couldn't communicate what she wanted clearly, even in the state where she was in discomfort, there was some very greedy part of me that was going to miss her, wasn't going to accept that, yeah, no, this is for the best, that, you know, she's going to be out of pain and out of comfort and peace and all that kind of thing, but I was very unhappy about it, but I had a little epiphany. There's a large bunch of tiger lilies on the table here, all sunny and tropical looking. Some of the petals have begun to wrinkle in age, others are just opening now. Some are still adorned with pollen, and others have lost their potency, but all are beautiful. All live and grow old, give beauty and take nourishment, pass on and nourish the soil for present and future flowers by their passing. But who mourns for a flower? One of my friends sat in her garden one fall, weeping for the decline of her plants, then felt stupid because they weren't really dying, just morphing into something else or going to sleep. It turns out something else was bugging her anyways. And the sight of her fallen flowers had just set her off. Nobody really weeps for flowers because we understand that their passing is an integral part of their life. And I don't think we're born so far less than flowers that we have to forego this integrity, this sense of completion and regeneration. I think we just lose touch with the fact that the beauty of the garden is the blossom of all souls together. I read her that, and I told her that I would be reading it here now. And she smiled and she nodded, and she understood. There was one poem that she was very fond of by a lady named Christina Rossetti. I was thinking about this yesterday, actually, when I was desperately trying to come up with something to say to all of you. And I did. I typed up a whole bunch of stuff, and I left it at home. So I'm just making it up. But it ended with the lines, better that you smile and forget than remember and be sad. And that was very important to her, and that's something that she wanted to convey. And that's a really nice thought, but I'm just not there yet. Because I miss her, and this sucks. I mean, her life is definitely a cause for celebration. But the removal of it from mine is still something that I miss. As I was thinking this, I was flipping through a book that I had, and I found another poem by the same author, Christina Rossetti, entitled My Friend. And I'm gonna try to read through it without freaking out, but if I do, it's not you. Just don't take it personally. Okay. 2 days ago, with dancing, glancing hair, with living lips and eyes, now pale, dumb, and blind she lies, so pale, yet still so fair. We have not left her yet, not yet alone, but we must soon leave her where she will not miss our care, bone of our bone. Weep not, O friends, we should not weep. Our friend of friends lies full of rest. No sorrow rackles in her breast, fallen fast asleep. She sleeps below, she wakes and laughs above. Today, as she walked, let us walk in love, and tomorrow follow so.
Yay, Robin!
Ah.